I talk of the time when the spear grass crackled under the billy, and overhead was the winter's sun. When there was snow on the hills and frost in the gully, when the swaggers walked from end to end of New Zealand looking for work. Apart from the Maori, if New Zealand has a folklore, it is the folklore of the early swagger, the folklore of the early station days. To understand the swagger, we must understand colonial New Zealand. Until gold was discovered, income in New Zealand was rural. New Zealand, at the earliest stage of its settlement, was partitioned into vast stations. The places settled were not the bushlands, the swamplands, but the grass and tussock lands. Thus the big stations grew up in the Wairarapa, in parts of Hawke's Bay, and in Canterbury and in Otago. Station work was seasonal, shearing, harvesting, and in those earliest days of our establishment, New Zealand exported much grain. We exported about £1 million of the wheat in 1 year. We've imported wheat almost every year since. Nearly every station had a swagger's hut. Now, why did it have a swagger's hut? Work was where men found it. In those early days, and in later years, in fact, I could find large numbers of folk who had established big businesses, who had been on the swag. When folk landed in New Zealand, if there wasn't a job after they had spent a period in the immigration barracks, they had to walk to find a job. No rural phones, no rural roads, no rural mail. Men knew when the season was about to start. I can remember as a child seeing groups of swaggers come to places near where we lived in Riversdale and erect their tents in various little forests that were about, waiting for the commencement of the harvesting or waiting for the commencement of the shearing. As McKee Wright says, there's a sound of many voices in the camp and on the track, and let us come up in shoals to stations at the back. And every boat that crosses from the sunny other side is bringing waves of shearers for the swelling of the tide. For the shearing's coming round, boys, the shearing's coming round, and the voices of the workers have begun to swell the sound. Yes, men went looking for work. Australia wasn't far away in those days. The term that was used so frequently, Australasia, was something real. As a matter of fact, there was a time when you could cross the Tasman and come back across the Tasman for 30 shillings. Even when I was a young man, I crossed from Wellington to Sydney and came back to Auckland for £6.10. But men, Australians, New Zealanders, they would cross to the various countries. Folk would shear from Queensland down to the Sydney or Melbourne boat and then cross to New Zealand and shear down through New Zealand. They were days not only of great working class athletes, for the original swaggers were not loafers, although the legend is largely perpetuated by the scamps. The original swaggers were working class athletes. They were men who could shovel more shingle when we were making a road, who could shear more sheep, who could stook more sheaves on a stack than anybody else. They were remarkable men. I have a story of one, they called him the Highland Chief, who was on the burst in Oamaru one night. He left at 11 o'clock, nearly in the DTs. He walked to the Omarama Station, got there in time for the roll call and the start of shearing, walked 40 mile actually with a swag on his back, and in that day shore more sheep than any man on the board. Those swaggers had to work, although, as I have said, the legend of the swagger, the lore of the swagger, is largely perpetuated by the scamp. Because in a world where nearly everybody works hard, the average man gets light relief. Exaggerating the scallywags and the scamps. When the job, when shearing was coming, what else was there to do? Roll up the swag, go searching for a job. You see, even Henry Lawson crossed to New Zealand and ended up for a few minutes or for a few months teaching at a school in Kaikoura. Made a bit of a job mess of it too and had to get out. But it was a world where men worked while there was work. When there was no work, they either had to tramp from station to station, or if they couldn't, if they had no cash, and in those days of no entertainment, cash didn't last long. Men, sure, built up a little bit of a check, probably steered into the nearest pub, blew it in, and then rolled the swag and walked. The swag, of course, were blankets, a few little odds and ends, rolled like a roll of bacon, an oil sheet rounded in New Zealand, a tent probably at times, the oil sheet and tent not necessary in Australia. The swag was never carried the way the modern hitchhiker carries his pack, with two straps on the shoulder. It was slung across, carried with a sling that rested on one shoulder and would be moved from shoulder to shoulder as the man walked. Nobody could go on the track with a portmanteau, as Lawson says. The most ungainly and tiresome means in the world of transporting a blanket and equipment is in a portmanteau. But when you roll a swag and you go on the swag, well, you can walk miles without suffering any great hardship. Now, I knew a lot about the swag because probably when I was a youngster, I'd walked over more of New Zealand than any man my age ever walked over New Zealand. You see, as a inmate of Burnham Industrial School, I escaped a few times and ran over a few provinces. And then later, when I shook the school off my heels altogether, managed to get clear away, I was constantly on the move because I was always afraid that somebody would find me in a job. And I became a swagger, to all intents and purposes, even when I was a teenager. I met up with such famous characters as the Shiner, while I was still a lad. Now, every station had a swagger's hut. Mutton was cheap, no refrigeration in those early days. All that we wanted from the sheep was the tallow from the boiling down and the wool. And every station had a shearer's and a swagger's hut. Any swagger moving from station to station when there wasn't work could be sure of a meal at night, a meal in the morning, and probably a couple of slices of bread and a piece of mutton to take him on the way. I called in at one of the last stations that was open in New Zealand. I came down into Palmerston South, and there was a station then closing down. It was about to be partitioned by the Sydney government, and I remember getting my plate of stew, a few potatoes, piece of bread, mug of tea, and the same sort of breakfast in the morning with a slice of bread to take on my way. The Swagger's Hut was part of New Zealand life. I've got records in an unpublished book of mine of vast congregations of swaggers in swaggers' huts when times were hard and when work was coming. I've got a story of about 80 swaggers congregating at Bishop Bennett's swaggers' hut from Saturday night until Sunday morning, and until Monday morning. If anybody called at Bennett's late on Saturday afternoon, they didn't have to move. He allowed them to go into the swagger's hut to wash their clothes, to feed themselves. He cared for them until Monday morning. And then they walked. Of course, the cost wasn't great. The cost was a slice or two of bread, a potato or two, and the abundant mutton that existed. I got a story of 100 swaggers camping on the Mimi Reserve at Waipawa. Don't know whether a Mimi Reserve exists now. Of a famous swagger character called Concertina Joe, who had once played his instrument before some of the greatest vaudeville houses in the world. And of him crawling out of his tent at twilight, the swaggers all congregating, and Concertina Joe giving them a concert. When he'd finished, he'd finished. No encores. Like a true artist, he knew when to stop. He gave them a good helping and then walked out. But the swagger was not a loafer. The swagger was a working class athlete. Don't make any mistake about that. Of course, there were no pensions in those days, no old men's homes. And there were far more men in New Zealand at the early stage than there were women. So that when men got too old to work, what was there for them to do but to walk? Walk the roads, stay at stations, cadge from the various settlers a meal. I've got records again of dozens of swaggers who were picked up frozen along the road. Dead. I've got their names in a book that I haven't as yet discovered. Well, when gold was discovered, of course, there was a flock of different people into New Zealand. There was a great incursion of a more or less adventurous, vagabond type. Folk who always are to be found on the frontiers of civilization. For New Zealand, in a sense, was then a frontier. We were taming a new land. And, of course, when the great collapse of prices and the great gold boom collapsed, thousands of these folk got out of New Zealand in a couple of years. I think 8,000 left in 1 year. But many were left. And these folk became more or less permanent wanderers as they got old. No old age pension. We didn't have the old age pension until 1908. And then it was hedged about by restrictions. The government had to heed folk at the time who claimed that to give elderly out-of-work people an old age pension would be to destroy the principles of thrift and industry. And there are all sorts of restrictions to prevent folk getting that 5 shillings a week. And if a man had ever had any convictions in the past, that also disqualified him. One thing we've learned in these modern times is that if a man has got convictions and comes out of jail at an early age, or at a late age, it's better to give him a pension. It's cheaper to give him a pension and allow him to live outside than to spend 3 or 4 times as much keeping him in jail. There was another class of person about that you found on the swag, and you'll never hear about them today. How long since I heard somebody say, he is a remittance man? Ne'er-do-wells of families, scallywags, who whose relatives thought that they'd be better on the other side of the world. And what's so good as New Zealand? Further away from Britain than any place. Give them a small remittance. Send them to New Zealand. And of course, if they were alcoholics, they would have a boom time if the remittance arrived, and they'd be on the road when the remittance wasn't there. How long it is since I heard somebody say, he is a remittance man. But associated with the working class athletes that I've talked about were a certain number of these scallywags, these scamps. There were men on the roads, still with an odd red shirt. Old Crimean veterans. You know, when we talk of the Crimean shirt, we want to realize that Hitler and Mussolini weren't the first to give men a distinctive shirt. The old veterans of the Crimea, a lot of them continued to wear the Crimean shirt long after the thin red line was forgotten completely. Now, as the great estates broke up, swagging wasn't quite so easy. Not anything like as easy. Because a lot of the folk who settled were comparatively poor. The great stations needed that constant flow of vagrant labour, but the small settler, he could look after himself, but he couldn't look after too many folk on the road. Yet it's astonishing the way farmers and early settlers did try out of their poverty to feed the swagger as he passed on his way. So many of them had been hard up themselves. So many of them knew what the hardship of no job meant to the average man. This was all before the great works of the liberal breakthrough started to have some effect. And elderly men on the road, before the age of the pension, probably continued to walk on the road for the rest of their lives. I was born at the collapse of the gold boom, or just shortly after. But Otago in particular knew its effects for 10, 20 years after. As a child, as an infant, I remember going to a soup kitchen with a jug to get a jug of soup. And I can see hundreds of people going to the soup kitchen to get a jug of soup. Elderly men, young men, whole families. There was a great amount of misery abroad in the land. And of course, it was out of that moment of misery that there came the urge for great political changes that gave us the force that brought about the great liberal breakthrough. But I went and got soup as an infant from the soup kitchen and took a jug home to my mother. There were many remarkable instances of the existence of the swagger that are still noted. The Oamaru paper, for instance, always noted the arrival of one celebrated New Zealand swagger in Oamaru, in its personal column. The Shiner arrived in Oamaru today at a certain time. And when the Shiner had departed, the Oamaru paper noted his departure. The Oamaru paper once rocked New Zealand by saying of two Australians passed through Oamaru yesterday, so far nothing is missing. The whole colony laughed. But, yes, swaggers were a fact of life. You saw them in the city as they passed through. I don't suppose they got much by begging in the city, but after all you had to pass through the various towns to go on to another station. McKee Wright, talking about the break up of the great stations, and the difficulty that the men on the road had accommodating themselves to the new circumstances for a time, says, "Well, there ain't much use in talking. I'd best hump my bluey on. There'll be goodish men and meanish men when we'll be dead and gone. I'd be happy as a skylark if I dropped across a job. And as for saving money, well, you know at 15 bob, with clothes and his tobacco, a chap won't have much to spare. But it's something that he'll miss a while, the hunger in the air." When I first went into Parliament, there were 40 men in the upper house, old people who had been appointed to the upper house by Seddon and other politicians. And there were at least 12 members in the upper house that I knew who had carried the swag at various times, become successful later on. I found 4 or 5 people who were members of Parliament who had carried the swag. After all, you could go into a pub those days and maybe stand up against the manager of a big business, and he'd put his foot on the rail and he'd start out, "Well, when I was on the swag." We nearly all knew Henry Lawson's poems, or some of them. Many a time I've sat by a fireside when a lot of working men were gathered, and I've heard them reciting a lot of the Australian outback verse. Heard somebody start off, "Say, Squire," said Stevens, "we back to it evens, the race is all over, bar shouting, they say," or somebody on telling the tale of Lasker, and so on. The swaggers were mighty workers. Some of them had been mighty entertainers. I've got a letter which tells me of one fellow who had once been a great platform entertainer in Britain, and one night somebody mentioned a music hall in Manchester, and he started to cry. The tears ran down his cheeks. He'd once performed there. Don't know whether he'd drunk himself out of the job or what it was. Of course, the lure of gold, apart from any other circumstance, brought a lot of people. But I think back to an uncle of my granduncle of mine. I met him in the old man's home, dying at the age of about 92 in Wellington. Now, he had succumbed to the lure of gold, and he'd never settled into a job. He was always looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And just by a stroke of luck, I found that old Benjamin Taylor was an uncle of mine. And I was told, see what happens once folk get the desire to tramp. I was told by the folk who were looking after the place that he was a great character. But even in his 90th year, he would regularly roll up a swag and swear that he was going to start up along the road. He'd go missing with a couple of the home's blankets, and about a couple of hours afterwards they'd get a call from the police to come with a motor car and pick him up and take him back to the old man's home. As a matter of fact, he couldn't talk intelligibly to me then. He was too old. He didn't know that I was his grandnephew. His face was turned to the wall, and I could hear him murmuring about the gene he'd left back in Bonnie, Scotland, over 70 years ago. The swaggers were remarkable workers, but the swaggers actually are perpetuated in legend more by the vagabonds, the scallywags. There was a great swagger law in this country years ago, and of course I've perpetuated some of it myself in a couple of books, and I've still got a book of swagger material that deserves publication. And one early settler of New Zealand wrote to me about 30 years ago, dead now. He told me, strangely enough, that the father that I never met was a great raconteur, and that he had perpetuated a lot of the Shiner stories. But I crossed the Waitaki River at Glenavy on one occasion, and there I met up with the Shiner in all of his glory, or all of his inglory. And what a contempt he had for a young-looking stripling like me. You know, he was the real thing. He was really the vagabond. And I was obviously an interloper. I had no right to be on the road at all. Amazing, the stories that were told about swaggers and that perpetuated the legend. They were told mostly about the work-shy men. Because, as I say, in a world where nearly everybody had to work hard for a living, they got their light relief by laughing at the vagabonds. I've got one story of a swagger who called at the Hunter's place in Hawke's Bay. And the Hunters had a great record for being kind to swaggers. Also got a record of 20 or 30 swaggers in the swaggers up there of a night. This swagger called, used to call regularly, knew Mr. Hunter, looked at him and he said, how about a pair of Mr. Trousers, Mr. Hunter? His trousers were worn out. And Hunter said, this is the only pair I've got. So the fellow said, oh, they'll do, Mr. Hunter. He said, they'll do. So Hunter, astounded at his
audacity
statement, he said, all right, and he went away and took them off and gave them to him. And he made the old fellow take off his old pants, you know, and put on the new ones. But the old fellow wouldn't part with the old. He kept them under his arm. And he started out toward, he was going to Woodville. Now Hunter was travelling in the same direction later in the day in his gig. And as he drove along, he overtook this swagger. And he said, oh no, before the swagger left, he said, you can't give me any money, can you, Mr. Hunter? Now he called back regularly on Hunter, and Hunter said, yes, he said, I'll give you a cheque for £1, he said, if you promise never to come back again for 3 months. And the swagger said, done. So Hunter gave him the cheque for £1. Hunter was driving his gig along in the same direction that the swagger was going, and he overtook him and he said, jump up, I'll give you a lift, he said, as far as I'm going anyhow. So this swagger jumped up and sat beside him. And after they'd driven along a few miles, he turned to Hunter and he said, I say, Mr. Hunter, he said, did you add exchange to that chick? Hunter reached in his pocket and found a sixpence for him. There were some remarkable characters. There was Piccolo Charlie. Piccolo Charlie was quite an artist on the piccolo. Amazing the number of instrumentalists, you know, who became swaggers. Don't make any mistake about it. Even good musicians find it hard to get a living. Many are called, but few are chosen. Is that it? Very good. Music is like art. It's more frequently the privilege of the poverty-stricken than of those who become wealthy. But Piccolo Charlie, he used to go around with his piccolo and a dog. Whenever he came to a group of men, he'd put down his hat and he'd play the music on the piccolo. And they'd drop a few coins into his hat and he'd start off again. And of course, add to his few shillings by catching an odd feed along the way. He used to stay in the Hokitika jail during the winter. He'd have wanted to swag in the South Island in the winter. The constable used to keep the door open, and he used to agree that Piccolo Charlie could jail his dog too. Piccolo Charlie would chop enough wood in the winter to last the constable until he came back the next year. When the late spring came, he'd leave the cell, call his dog and walk over the mountains to Christchurch. I've got one story of him calling at Greymouth on one occasion when they were making the breakwater. And he walked down to where they were making the breakwater and he saw a big crowd there. And he wondered what was up. So he walked down and he said, "What's up? What are you all gathered here for?" And they said, "Well, the monkey's fallen off the pile driver. The monkey was drowned in the Grey River." "Oh," he said, "the monkey is drowned, is it?" He put down his hat, picked up his piccolo, and he played the dead march in Saul for the monkey, and raised some cash. There was a famous artist of great platform capacity, only exercised in a pub, Crying Harry. Whenever there was a big payday at any big station and he was about, he'd go into the pub. And when the fellas arrived to blow in their check, he'd start to cry. And he'd start to sob, heart-rending sobs. He'd move everybody else to tears. Even when they had heard him before, he was such a performer that they'd feel a lump coming into his throat. So somebody would ask him, "What's up?" So Crying Harry would say, "Well, he said, "I've just heard news from Britain. My poor mother's dead." He said, "And oh, I was shameful to her. I never did what I could to help my poor mother." And he said, "I'm broken-hearted at the thought of it." And he'd sob and the tears would run down his cheeks. So they'd all buy him beer to soothe the pain. And I'm told that even folk who had seen the trick performed two or three times would willingly buy beer because of the immaculate performance. They'd all have lumps in their throat. There, of course, the Shiner. The Shiner was the fellow who walked into a pub and asked a publican whether he'd take stamps. "I've got no money." And the publican said, "Yes, I'll take stamps." So the Shiner ordered a beer and drank the beer. And the Shiner said, "Where are the stamps?" And the Shiner stamped three times on the floor and walked out. And then the publican ran after him, going to brain him. But he finally said, "Look, there's another publican down at the other end of the town." He said, "You put that trick across him and I'll give you another beer." So the Shiner went down to the other end of the town and put the trick across the other publican and then came back and got a third beer. Now, honestly, that's good business. That's what you call compound interest, isn't it? My father, I'm told by this outback character who wrote to me years ago, used to tell the story of the Shiner and the Linnet. As a matter of fact, this fellow reckoned that my father was a partner in this little bit of skullduggery. They were walking together along a Canterbury Road. And they passed a dead spud. It was at the time of the height of the bird explosion when they were poisoning birds right and left. And my father said, is alleged to have said with a smile on his face, "That's a linnet." And the Shiner said, "No, it's a spug." "No," he says, "it's a linnet. It's a spug." And they walked on a few yards and the Shiner said, "Wait a minute, I've got an idea." He said, "Let's go back and get that linnet." So there was a pub up the way and they surveyed the pub and they surveyed who was in the pub. And then the Shiner went in with this spug and laid it on the counter and he said, "Look at the heartless creatures killing that poor linnet." And it was a new publican who didn't know the Shiner. And everybody said, of course, "Linnet, sparrow, you don't know what you're talking about." So the Shiner said, "Well, I'll bet you drinks that that bird's a linnet." And yes, they decided, and my father was alleged to be standing outside with his ear cocked to the conversation. And the Shiner said, "Well, yes, and the decision is to be by the first man who comes in. We'll ask the first person who comes in what that bird is." So according to the story as I heard it, in goes Gypsy Lee, and they put the question to him. So he looks at the bird carefully. Takes a long time to make up his mind. They ask why he isn't making a quick judgment, but he says, you know, he's an ornithologist. He wants to have a good look at the bird. And then, of course, when he's got them all keyed up, he naturally says it's a linnet. And they have drinks all round, and then a stranger comes in, another man comes in who knows the shiner, and says, hello, the shiner. Of course, they all know then that they've been had. So they shout drinks all round again, because they've got a good story to tell. There's the story of the shiner, who down on his luck once had to work. Now, the shiner was work shy. He didn't work. He never robbed anybody. He was welcomed by women. They liked to get him into their homes to dance an Irish jig. He always went to Catholic church on Sunday and always walked up to a front pew. And all of the early Irish settlers used to say when they saw him coming to the door, the poor man, you know, the good staunch Catholic. So if they had a little bit of steak and onions and a nice little bit of gravy, the shiner made his religion pay handsomely. But there's a story that once down on his luck he had to work. There was a young fella who had no respect for old vagabonds who said, well, I'll give you a meal and I'll pay you a certain amount if you'll clean out a well that's collapsed. The shiner took on the job, much against his will. He could work. The shiner could work if he wanted to. He could give a demonstration of working. He was a great demonstrator. He could show an ability to work for 5 minutes that would astound anybody, as long as he didn't have a permanent job. A real showman when it came to work. Well, he got busy on this well, and he threw the earth in all directions, but made the digging as narrow as he could, and he got out to have a swig at his billy of tea, and the confounded earth collapsed in. Well, now, what a distressing position for for the poor old shiner. Was he to dig that well out again? No, he threw his coat in on the collapsed earth and his hat, and he went away to a pine plantation about 100 yards away and fell asleep. And then when they came looking for the shiner to see how he was getting on, the news went all around the country. The well has collapsed on the shiner. And folk came from all directions to dig the shiner out. So they did the shiner's job, and when it was done, the shiner came from the plantation rubbing his eyes. He could almost congratulate them on the job well done. And of course, generally when they were tricked like that, they paid up and were pleased to have a story to tell somebody else. There's another occasion in which somebody who knew him, the owner of a station, said, you really want a job, shiner? He said, yes, I want a job. He said, I've got to have a few bob. And the station owner said, look, you can trim that hedge out there up to the cabbage tree. There's a cabbage tree stuck in the hedge. And he said, I'm leaving today. He said, I'll leave the money with the cook. And he said, the cook won't pay you until you've trimmed that hedge up to the cabbage tree. So while the station owner was there, the shiner set to work. The sweat poured down his cheeks and the fronds of the gorse hedge fell down. But after a while, the owner departed, and the shiner went away and up to the cabbage tree, chopped the cabbage tree off, brought it back and planted it in the confounded hedge, and went and got hold of the cook. Now, the cook hadn't been shown the location. The cook had only been told to chop it up to the cabbage tree. So the shiner collected. I remember seeing the shiner dance a jig at the Omru show. When he was a very old man, he didn't win a prize on that occasion, too old, but later on the hat went round and he got more in the hat than the average person got who had won the prize for the jig. Actually, he used to turn up at the Oamaru Caledonian Society Sports every year to dance a jig for years. I've also got a register of an old Caledonian gathering at which the famous cash athlete Donald Dinney appeared. I've got Donald Dinney signing the register, the prize register, for about 7 items. He was the greatest cash athlete in history. He won dancing, tossing the caber, running, wrestling. And I've also got the Shiner's signature for a second prize for dancing the jig. Quite an interesting feature. We had numerous characters like that all over the country. There was the Bone Ring Man. The Bone Ring Man made tie rings of sheep bones. You used to see a lot of them once. They'd dry the bones, of course, get the marrow out, and carve a piece of bone that they'd inset with a little piece of a parva shell. I've got one at home. The Bone Ring Man. Down on his luck, no jobs, probably a genuine swagger, a worker. He'd make bone rings and sell an odd one to farmers, and you'd find people all over the South Island once upon a time wearing a tie ring. Anyhow, I've got one at home. There was another fellow, an engraver, who used to do remarkable engraving on the back of watches or tin pannikins and tin plates. And where have the tin pannikins and tin plates gone? Why, they used to be in New Zealand in thousands, but they've all gone. He used to engrave and make many a shilling with his engraving when work wasn't available. The Ship in the Bottle Man. There was a time when you could go to the various farms round the South Island and you'd find countless ships in bottles. But where have the ships in bottles gone? They've all gone. There was one fellow who used to stand his swag. He always made a long, tall swag, and he used to stand it in front of a house and make sure that the folk inside the house knew where he was, and then he'd pretend he was half mad, and he'd fall upon it and punch the living daylights out of the swag before he'd catch. And generally, after people had seen him in action with both fists, they'd cough up quick and busy. There was a famous character who called himself the Honourable John Burke O'Brien. Now, John Burke O'Brien was part-time hawker, part-time swagger. He was the fellow I talked about who in the early days rung the a station master in the South Island to hold an express train because the Honourable John Burke O'Brien would be 10 minutes late. And of course, the fellow impressed by the fact that he was the Honourable John Burke O'Brien held the train. And O'Brien turns up, throws his swag onto the platform and says, "The Honourable John Burke O'Brien's aboard, let the train go." Now, John Burke O'Brien always wore a frock coat and a top hat and moleskin trousers, of course, but hand-me-down frock coats and top hats were easy to come by those days. There were still a lot of genteel people who wore top hats, and even the shop walkers wore frock coats. And if you've got an ordinary working man's coat, when it becomes second-hand, everybody wanted it those days. But who in the name of heavens wanted a top hat and frock coat at second-hand remove, except the Honourable John Burke O'Brien? You can't imagine a fellow going looking for a shearing job in a top hat and a frock coat, but it was part of the props for John Burke O'Brien. Now, John Burke O'Brien, he was noted for sometimes entering, when he was hawking, in some of the cities, stopping at a horse trough. And he'd strip right down, except for his moleskin trousers, and have a bath in the horse trough. Everybody would gather round, and he'd relate stories of his tramps, and he'd come out dripping wet, and then try to sell whatever he was hawking. I've got numerous stories about John Burke O'Brien trying to bathe in a horse trap. But the best story I have about him always makes me wonder whether it pays to advertise or whether it pays to insure. I don't know what the moral of this story is, but O'Brien was another fellow who generally went to jail in winter. In midwinter, if he was in Wellington, he'd do something to get himself locked up in the Terracen jail. Terracen jail was called by the old hands in those days McGarvey's Hotel. And he was in there one winter, and they turned him out as spring came. But it was a howling Wellington day, all brutally cold, rain pouring down. A wretched time to turn a man out of jail, give a man his freedom to be battered about by a great southern gale. Chilled bones, little money, no food. But John Burke O'Brien had an idea. He went down to an insurance company and he said, "Look, have you got that letter yet about the insurance policy that is due to me and that is to be sent to your Wellington office?" He'd introduced himself first as the Honourable John Burke O'Brien, of course, and by that he was in the manager's office before they realised what a scam he was. They looked everywhere. There was no letter. But he argued. And finally the manager said, "Well, if you don't get out, I'll have you thrown out." He'd made a nuisance of himself. So John Burke O'Brien went outside, picked up a boulder and put it through the insurance manager's window. And the manager called the police, and O'Brien was locked up in McGarvey's Hotel again for another month, much to his delight. But it was one of those awful damned winters. When the month was up, the wind still blew and the rain still fell. So there was poor old John Burke O'Brien in the same position. But lightning sometimes strikes twice. He put a brick in his pocket and he went down to the insurance office, and this time he didn't ask to be shown into the manager's office. He knew he'd never be shown in. He knew where it was. So he rushed in quick, opened the door and sat down in front of the manager. And the manager says, "Get the hell out of this," he said. "I'll have it thrown out." So John Burke O'Brien reached in his pocket and pulled out the stone and put it on the desk. The manager said, "Give me that stone." "No," he said, "you don't." And he weighed it in his arm. "You know," he said, "that's a beautiful window you got." And the manager said, "Yes, a good window." And he said, "You know, that gale," he said, "and the rain," he said, "will blow right in and the windows bust," he said. "Fall right down," he said, "on the back of your neck." And the manager started to stir. "Don't move," he said, "don't move," he said. "The stone can travel quicker than you." So the manager said, "Yes, you're right." "Well," he said, "look, you're an insurance officer, a manager." He said, "Now, do you believe in insurance?" He said, "Look, I'll insure that window for 5 bob, he said, "for 2 years for you. 5 bob, he said, "and that window will be safe for 2 years. The manager said, "I believe in insurance." He didn't want to have the gale blowing down on the back of his neck. Now, I don't know whether the moral of that story is that it paid John Burke to advertise or whether it paid the manager to insure. No, these swaggers, those vagabonds, they were great scamps. Great stories are told about them. I've got hundreds of stories. I've got stories of the men who died along the roads. But as I have said always, the overwhelming bulk of the swaggers were great working class athletes. The men who built New Zealand, the men who chopped the bush, who drained the swamps, who built the roads, who built the railways. They left their mark on New Zealand. But of course an odd few were scamps. And of course many of the working class athletes, the men who had fought in the Crimea, men who had served in India, men who had borne the brunt of empire building, A lot of them died along the tracks. And you know, some swaggers had great clairvoyance. I always think of Henry Lawson and the verse of his. There are men for the frontier. There was a time when the restless people were shipped off to the frontiers of the world, but there are no longer frontiers. And Lawson foresaw that unless those restless ones had some frontier to be shipped to, they'd subsequently disturb society. I've often looked at these verses of his, two out of his Rover and a Rebel. A rover and a rebel, conceived and born to roam, as babies they will toddle with faces turned from home. They've fought beyond the vanguard, wherever storm has raged, and home is but a prison, they pace like lions caged. A rover and a rebel, and so the world's commenced. Their hearts shall beat as wildly 10 generations hence. And when the world is crowded, 'tis signed and sealed by fate, the roving blood will rise to make the countries desolate. And my word, you almost see some of that around us today. No frontiers for the rover and the rebel, the remittance man type, to be shipped to. They're busy upsetting the society in which we live. The shiner would dress in anything that was old and that was warm. I saw him with a Norfolk jacket, tattered, pair of trousers, an old white straw hat, with of course the sweat showing through the band. He was the only swagger I ever saw carrying a swag and with an umbrella for the rain. I've got a photo of him, probably the last photo taken, and he's wearing a kepi. I've got a story of him which showed that he believed in the values of advertising. He wanted to get a pair of trousers from an old friend who, and the son, the old friend had died. The son wouldn't give him his father's trousers. Now, the shiner being a good Catholic, and the son being a good Catholic, he thought he'd show him just how necessary the trousers were. So he patched the trousers that he had with the label of a white Fleming's flour bag. Had the label right across his seat. And on Sunday, he walked into the Catholic church, the last man in, and walked up to the front pew so that everybody in the church could see the poor old devout man with his trousers patched with an advertisement that advertised Fleming's flour. Believe me, when the service was over, the son was shamed into telling the shiner that he'd give him his father's trousers if he'd call around. The shiner was not only given personal mention in the Oamaru paper every time he arrived, and his departure from Oamaru was also dutifully recorded, but he received wide obituaries when he died. In the Otago Daily Times, I've got the copy of the obituary. A photo and a good obituary note in the old Otago Witness, in the Otago papers, and in many other papers, because he was known from end to end of New Zealand. He was born in County Clare. He died at the age of 85. As I've said before, he could work when he wanted to. He could give a demonstration of work that would shame anybody for 5 minutes. But when the demonstration was over, he was an amateur worker. He'd work 5 minutes for fun, but I'm damned if he'd work for a living. Well, you can understand that. If a man can be an amateur athlete, why shouldn't a man be an amateur worker? He was an original. And he'd work for 5 minutes and show everybody else how they should work. And then when he saw them started, he'd also show that work was something that wasn't good for him. When a man's got the health and strength to lay in bed on a morning like this, why should he get up and work? Well, that would be about the China's mother.